that learning should be a schus, and certainly our tefillas and our attention should be towards our nation, the situation in Eretz Yisrael, which Baruch Hashem seems to be heading in a very, very good way, but it's very, very dangerous. Certainly on a personal level, quite a number of soldiers who are in extreme danger. And any time you go into an enemy land, and an enemy who knows no boundaries, you know, if your enemy would just love to blow himself up, as long as he can take one, he'll kill himself. It's a very dangerous situation. And when you enter their land, which is booby-trapped, etc., there's a tremendous, tremendous sakana. So it really is behooves us to carefully make sure that we do our part, which is davening, which is learning. And I'd like to dedicate the shiur this evening that the soldiers and civilians in Eretz Yisrael should all be well, and this should end quickly in the best way for the Jewish nation. Yosef became the viceroy over Mitzrayim, and it's very clear that his situation was about absolute power. Now, absolute power is something that's almost non-existent in our society. In our society, there are many checks and balances. There are many, many forces that will mitigate your control. But in the good old day, a monarch was the boss. What that means in plain language is, if the monarch didn't like you, he killed you. Without rhyme, without reason, he was totally, absolutely all-powerful in the land. The position that Yosef was given by Paro was, no one will raise his leg or his foot in Mitzrayim without you. Yosef was given effectively carte blanche, permission to set policy, permission to write laws. He was given almost absolute monarchy. And he was an extraordinarily powerful position that he shared. The Pasuk says, Yosef hu ha-shalit, Yosef was the ruler, al ha-eretz, hu ha-mashbir. He was the one who sustained the land. And the Sfarnos is bothered by what seems to be a contradiction between those two terms. Shalit is the ruler. He was all-powerful. He was the single figure who made the laws. The mashbir is the one who would actually sort of like give out the food. And the mashbir would be sort of the person who, almost like the cook who stands at the head of the line, giving out the food. And the Sfarnos is bothered by those two terms don't seem to gel together very well. Says the Sfarnos as follows: he was the shalit, he was the ruler, and he himself was the person who sold all of the wheat. All of the wheat in Mitzrayim was something that Yosef was involved in every single sale. V'lo yamamim bavodav, he didn't trust his servants. Why is that? There was a fortune of money that was passing hands here. In fact, all of the wealth of Mitzrayim, all of the wealth in the surrounding areas were going to pass from the people's hands into Paro's hands. V'ro'i l'paro, all of that money was fit to be Paro's. And therefore, because he didn't trust his servants not to steal, not to skim off the top, and therefore, lo yashum bar nimka lakonim, not a single drop of wheat was sold to any of the purchases, built the chosmo of Savyadu without his signature, without him being actually involved in the contract. Every single transaction that happened in Mitzrayim involving wheat, Yosef was personally involved in, personally signed on those contracts. And here is the question that I'd like to share with you on the Sfarno. Imagine for a minute that Yosef was a very, very intelligent fellow. And we have to imagine that he was quite intelligent by the fact that Paro singled him out for his brilliance, for his wisdom. And he said the words, there is no one in Mitzrayim like you. There is no one with your foresight, no one with your vision. If this man is brilliant, and this man is extraordinarily insightful, couldn't he figure out a system to set up in Mitzrayim that would basically keep control? Meaning as follows: there's an awful lot of wheat. All of the wheat was stored up during the 7 years of plenty. All of that wheat is going to be sold. Effectively, a fortune of money is going to pass hands. There are systems of checks and balances that you set up. You have a good manager in charge. You have someone watching the books. You have someone watching him. You have various different checks and balances to make sure that no one's cheating. And basically, most of the money would get to Paro. And apparently, the Sfarno, while granting that, says that Yosef was not satisfied with that. He didn't trust his avodim, he didn't trust his servants, and he demanded that every single transaction he be involved in himself because he was afraid of stealing. And the question is, number one, why couldn't Yosef set up a system and granted there might be some graft, 2%, 1%, but after all, he's the viceroy. He's not responsible to be there on the scene 24/7 signing every contract. And more than that, didn't he have better things to do with his time? Just to give you an illustration as to who the man was, all of the Torah that Yaakov had learned when he was in the yeshiva Shem Ve'ever, Yaakov spent 14 years without sleeping in a bed. He had given over to Yosef by the time Yosef was 17. Yosef was a tremendous masmid, a tremendous, brilliant Torah thinker. I have to imagine that he had better things to do with his time than sitting there all day long signing on wheat contracts. Every single person who would come in, he'd have to be involved in the selling. It's not lefi kvodo. It's not appropriate for the viceroy to be doing that. It's surely not an effective use of his time. And even if you'll tell me that there's some graft that might come out, I'm sure he could set up systems that would basically eliminate it. And if a little bit is stolen, it's not such a big deal. By the way, keep in mind the fact that Yosef alone made Paro the most wealthy individual of that generation. Before Yosef came up with his brilliant plan, Paro was a king. After Yosef enacted the plan, Paro owned all of the land in Mitzrayim, all of the land in the surrounding areas, because initially people came with whatever money they had the first year and they bought wheat to sustain themselves. After the first year, their money ran out, then they brought their metaltlin, the various horses, the camels, whatever they had. After that, it was the land itself that they had to sell. And at a certain point, Paro owned everything. He was literally the landlord. Yosef brought him from a regular king to the most powerful, wealthy king. Granted, the money was fit, but if a little bit got lost in the interim, it wouldn't have been Yosef's fault. He would have been very much recognized for the brilliant person, scrupulous person he was. Why did he have to sign every single star to make sure that nothing was lost to Paro? And I'd like to see if we could focus on answering this question and getting a better understanding of a certain concept. And to do that, let me begin with something I find very interesting. In the 1820s, the Rothschilds were already established as international bankers. There were five Rothschild brothers, each one in a separate country, and each house of the Rothschild was a powerful, powerful bank. They were the financiers of kings. They were the financiers of wars. They had unimaginable wealth. And they were internationally recognized as bankers and tremendous resources. Nathan Rothschild lived in England. In the 1820s, one of the other Rothschild houses sent a note to Nathan Rothschild. It was written from another country. Nathan Rothschild brought it to the Bank of England to cash. He brings this note into the Bank of England, and the president of the bank tells him as follows: "We apologize, but we only cash English notes. We don't cash personal notes if it's not from the Bank of England." At which point Rothschild fumed, and he said, "A Rothschild note is not a personal check." He walks out. The next day, he shows up with a little sack. He walks over to the teller. And keep in mind, this was the 1820s, the gold standard was the way of the world. And one of the laws in England at the time, which is basically the gold standard, is that currency represents gold that's backing it. Any citizen has a right to bring an English note into the bank and get the gold that's represented by that piece of paper. He walks in with a small sack, walks over to the teller, pulls out a 10-pound note, and asks for the gold that backs it. The teller is a little embarrassed, but listen, a law is a law. The teller goes into the vault, brings out 10 pounds worth of gold, and gives it to Nathan Rothschild. At which point he pulls out another note, sends the teller back to the vault. And he pulls out another note, and another note, and another note, and another note. But he's not alone. He has 9 clerks with him. The entire day they sat there with 10-pound notes, one after another after another. That day they redeemed 100,000 pounds worth of currency, which in today's millions of dollars. And when the bank closed that day, they left. The next day, Nathan Rothschild comes back with a small pouch, along with his 9 clerks. The president of the bank comes over to him with a sort of nervous smile and says, how long will the jest continue? Until the Bank of England recognizes a Rothschild note. And he walks back up to the teller, pulls out his £10 notes, and begins the scene again. There was a hasty board of directors meeting called, at which point they agreed that any Rothschild note would now be recognized and honored by the Bank of England. Okay, a cute story, but here's the observation. £100,000 by 10 men in one day means there were 10,000 transactions. That means each man was involved in about 1,000 transactions. Nathan Rothschild stood there all day long without moving from the spot. £10 note after £10 note. What motivated the guy? You may say, I'm sure a part of it was the fact that from a business standpoint, it's very important that the House of Rothschild be recognized. But I think there was another part involved. How dare you insult the name Rothschild? And there was a very real sense of hurt pride, injured pride. And I think this is a very classic example of what we human beings are involved in often. It's what I call multiplicity of intent. Oftentimes, there are many reasons that we do things. As a matter of fact, a good rule of thumb is that usually there are 2 reasons we do things. The real reason and what we tell everyone else. Usually, there are quite a number of motivating forces. Usually, there are quite a number of reasons why we do things. It may have a certain political advantage, it may have a certain strategic advantage, but oftentimes it's a hurt pride and something that touches my ego and sets me off to do something with alacrity, with a zrizus that I never would have had otherwise. What the Surah is saying is there was one reason why Yosef did what he did, because this money was fit to be by Paro. It was ro'i for Paro. Paro's the king, it should be his money. That was the sole reason that Yosef did this. And you have to appreciate what he did. He sat there all day long signing every single transaction. There were thousands of people who came to the palace, the entire Mitzrayim, all of the surrounding regions had a famine. The lines were all day long. He sat there doing nothing but acting like a merchant, even though he surely didn't have to, even though it was well beneath his dignity. But it was appropriate, it was proper. Why? Because this is Paro's money. This is what's right, this is what's proper. And believe me, there was no honor for Yosef in it. He was the viceroy. He was the single most powerful person in Mitzrayim. He walked into the room, you stood at attention until he said to sit. But he didn't stand on his covered, quite the opposite. He acted as a total, total merchant, sitting there signing each document, because only then could he know that the money that was fit to go to Paro should go to Paro, because he took responsibility. He felt it was his achrayus, his responsibility, that this should be Paro's money. He's the king. It's ro'i fit to be by him. I can't trust anybody else. They'll skim off the top. They'll pocket the money. Granted, I could set up systems, but it'll never be foolproof. And he sat there all day long, because that's what a responsible person does. He makes sure that that's what's supposed to happen, happens. And I find this a very, very powerful lesson. Because believe me, Yosef had much better things to do with his time. He was a tremendous masmid. Shemoneh Esrei could last an hour. He could chazar shas many, many times. But there's a certain time in your life when this is what you're supposed to be doing, and that takes precedence. If this is what's appropriate, this is what's proper, if responsibility demands that this is what I do, then it takes precedence over everything else, even if there's not much honor in it, even if I'm not given great cover, and even if it's not fun. But it's what I'm supposed to do, it's what's right, it's what's appropriate, and that sense of responsibility, I believe, is a very powerful lesson that you see from Yosef HaTzadik. And I think that this concept is very, very nogea in our times. And let me explain to you why. It should be very, very easy to be good. I'll explain to you why. Hashem is good. Hashem is the Meitiv. Hashem is the benefactor. Hashem is magnanimous. Hashem created everything in this world for one reason, to give of His good to man. Hashem benefits not an iota from anything in this creation. Everything that Hashem made was to give to us. Hashem is good. Hashem gave us a Torah to make us good. By keeping the Torah, by perfecting ourselves, we become good, so that when we leave this earth, we can enjoy the total, absolute, unending good, the world to come. Hashem is good. The Torah was given for us to become good, so that we can enjoy the good in the world to come. And that's how the Sefer HaChinuch explains the concept of the Torah. That being said, shouldn't it be obvious and simple to be good? It's all for our good anyway. It's what's right. It's what's proper. Hashem is good. Keeping the Torah makes me good. And I'm going to have the ultimate good, which is eternity and perfection and enjoyment forever. So it should be a no-brainer. It should be easy to be good. Keep the Torah and everything's fine. And yet, it's not so easy. As a matter of fact, the more you study the Torah, and the more you really understand the demands of the Torah, and the more you understand how much a human being is expected to do, the more difficult it becomes. And you quickly recognize that something's out of balance here. And the Mesillas Yesharim explains to us in very clear terms what is out of balance. He says, if that were so obvious and so true, there would be no effective Bechira. In theory, a person would have free choice, but not practically. You see, knowing the fact that every mitzvah helps me, shapes me into what I'll be for eternity, every avera damages me and hurts me, if I ever fully got that, then effectively I would lose free will. In theory, I would have free will, but not practically. As we mentioned many times before, if I challenge you, do you have free will to put your hand in a fire? The answer is, in theory, you could put your hand in a fire, but you wouldn't do it. Not for $100, not for $1,000. Why? Because it's foolish. So in theory, you have free will to put your hand in a fire. But practically you don't, because it's so foolish, you would never do it. So too, if everything were clear, if everything was simple, the human would have theoretical free will, but not practical. Because Hashem is good, the Torah makes me good, I'll enjoy the good for eternity, is so obvious and so simple that no human being would have practical free will. We'd all be in this state of robots, automatons, just doing what we're pre-programmed to do. And therefore, the Mesillas Yesharim explains to us that Hashem put us in a place where there are rabim, many, many things that pull us away from Hashem, many, many temptations, many, many desires, many things that make it very, very difficult to serve Hashem. And the correct vision of the world is not this rosy, comfortable picture, but quite the opposite. And so Sham's description of this world, as he says, it's a war. You ever hear the expression, it's a war out there? It's a war out there. But the forces of those wars are the forces of good, the forces of bad. The human is ever challenged, ever tempted. He's in a constant state of desire and needing to resist that desire. But that's the purpose of creation. My ability to say, I'm the master of the ship, I'm in charge and I resist, that's ultimately what allows me to reach godless greatness and perfect myself as a human here. And that is a very fundamental understanding of life. It's a battle, and we have to use all the forces that we can. Now, one of the forces are rather obvious, and we discuss it a lot, motivational sources. A person has to get up in the morning and have drive, enthusiasm. A person has to learn Musar. A person has to have a tremendous understanding of the various forces that will get him up and get him driven, because it's hard to fight. But one of the key forces that a human being must tap into is a sense of responsibility. And this is what's appropriate, this is what's right, this is what's proper, and therefore I do it. Even if it's not fun, even if I'm not driven, even if it's not the most motivating thing in the world, I do it because it's right and it's proper. And if you'd like a prime example of that, you listen to the Marine Corps credo. The Marine Corps is based on one simple formula: God, the country, the Corps. It's God, the country, and then it's the Marine Corps. That's my allegiance, that's what focuses me, and that's what drives me in everything I do, and that's one of the key themes of the Marine Corps. Now, That being said, I'd like to take a little break for a minute to do something we don't do enough of, a little comparative religions. We don't do much of this, so let me share with you a little comparative religions. Some of you may remember back from your olden studies, Greek mythology. I'd like to share with you an interesting story of Greek mythology. It's of Minerva and Arachne. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but Minerva was the daughter of Jupiter. She was the one who was in charge of all the useful and ornamental arts, agriculture, navigation, and weaving. As it turns out, there was this peasant girl, Arachne, who was a very, very skilled weaver. And she was so skilled that all of the nymphs, the wood nymphs, as well as the water nymphs, began congregating to watch her weave. She would weave these beautiful tapestries, magnificent tapestries. And word got back to Minerva that there was a mortal who was a better weaver than she. And she was furious. Her honor was being challenged. And one day, one of the nymphs said to Arachne, "Is it true that Minerva herself taught you how to weave?" At which point Arachne said, "She didn't teach me anything. She can't teach me anything. I'm the best weaver by far, and I weave better than anyone." When word came back to Minerva that a mortal dare challenged her and said that she was superior to Minerva, Minerva was furious. She shows up at Arachne's door and challenges her to a weaving contest. And in fact, they sit down to a contest, and they each pull out the loom, and they each begin weaving the goddess Minerva over here, the regular mortal Arachne over here. They're weaving and weaving and weaving, and after a certain time, it was time to judge the two works. As it turns out, no one less than the goddess Envy was brought to judge them, and everyone agreed that Arachne was the superior weaver. She had created a much superior tapestry. And when Minerva heard this, she was so angry. She went over to Arachne's tapestry and she ripped it to shreds. And then she started pounding, beating on Arachne. "How dare you insult the goddess Minerva?" And she began pounding her to within an inch of her life, at which point she stopped and she said, "Rather than kill you, you'll hang for eternity. And that's how you'll weave." And she turned her into a spider, and that's how spiders came into being. And that's the story. Isn't that nice? Isn't that a nice tale? Now, I don't tell that to my kids for Betty Bye-Time stories. Would you like to know why I don't tell it to my children? Because it's a little too silly. My kids are a little too sober. They would, "Oh, come on, Dad, cut it out." "Oh, yeah, right. That's it, they're in the spider, and he hangs up by the and weaves. And, yeah, right, come on, cut me a break." But I want to share with you why I tell you this story. Besides the silliness of this, let's take one very important focus point over here. Minerva is a goddess, but she's acting like a child. She's jealous, she's petty, she's vengeful. "Oh, you weave better than me. I'll start beating you, I'll make you hang, and you'll weave that way," and it turns her into a spider. She's acting juvenile. They don't make gods like they used to. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. The distinction between the immature and the mature manifests itself in a number of ways. The immature is impetuous. The immature has no control. The immature acts without reason, without thinking, is ruled by its passions, ruled by whatever mood affects it. The mature person, or goddess, is ruled by wisdom, controls one's emotions, sees the results, looks into the future, and controls its behaviors by guiding principles. And the reason why I share with you this particular point is because I believe that focusing on the difference between the mature and the immature is a very telling and important indication of what society understands to be a human today. And I'll explain to you in very simple terms. My little guy, Yoel, is 5 years old. I gave up already. I long ago gave up on asking him what he wants. Because if I ask him, "Do you want the truck or the candy?" The truck lasts for years. The candy lasts for a minute. The truck costs $6. The candy costs 50 cents. The truck you could play with over and over and over, and the candy is gone. Invariably, Yoel, who is 5, will choose the candy, not the truck. And I gave up. I said, "Fine, I will never win until you get a little bit of das, until you get a little bit older, until you're able to push off the momentary impulse and the desire for a future point. Now, let me share with you exactly where I'm headed with this. Part of my job as a father is to read stories to my children. And one of the books that I've read just sort of piqued my curiosity in a very powerful way. It's the Berenstain Bears. Now, if you're not familiar with the Berenstain Bears, there's Mama Bear, Papa Bear, Sister Cub, and Brother Cub. And what hit me at some point is, because I read a number of them, is there's a common theme that repeats itself many times in the storyline. And that is the cubs are immature, but so too is Papa Bear. As a matter of fact, Papa Bear is usually far more immature than are the cubs. The one who screams the loudest, the one who bangs on the table the most, the one who leaves his dirty dishes more often is Papa Bear. And it requires Mama Bear in the end to scold and put straight both the cubs and Papa Bear. Now, the first time I read this, I said, like, what's this about? And then I read another one and another one. And every time, Papa Bear is this buffoon, this oaf, this dope, this juvenile character. And it's only Mama Bear who's the mature one. Now, folks, I ain't no scholar and I ain't no saint, but I sure don't believe that in my household that that's the way it is. I hope that my wife and I both are the mature adult and the kids are the kids. Now, I'd like to share with you what I find very telling. If you'd like to study the American culture, go to the greeting card sections on Father's Day. And what you'll find is lazy, uninvolved fools. What you'll find is the fathers are painted as immature, irresponsible, beer-guzzling, basically children. And it's amazing because if you pick up greeting card after greeting card that describes this, you get a very interesting sort of like quizzical thought, like, what does this mean? Now, I'll be honest, I'm a bit handicapped because I don't watch television, but I do know what TV shows used to be like in the 50s. In the 50s, the typical situation comedies involved certain very, very particular situations. There was Father Knows Best, Make Room for Daddy, My Three Sons. In those situation comedies, the father was intelligent, dependable, and well-respected by the family and the community. Modern-day situation comedies are a bit different. Homer Simpson, Raymond Barron, portrayed as selfish and mindless, and basically drinking beer, watching TV, or playing golf, and they're usually pretty poor at that as well. And the concept of self-discipline, prudence, sobriety from the father figure is lacking. Would you like to know why I believe that's true? Because the stereotypical father is much like Homer Simpson. There's a lot of truth to it, because the culture we live in stresses be a juvenile, be an infant, do what you want, sit there on the couch, grab your remote, drink your beer, and you can be what you want to be, and don't bother me with issues like intelligence, sobriety, discipline, being a father. And I'm not going to say this swath cuts across everyone, but if you look out there, the images that are portrayed and what really seems to be what's out there is a tremendous sense of a lack of responsibility, a lack of maturity, a lack of any sort of giving up my instant gratification for anything that's far-reaching and anything that's important. And my friends, what I'd like to share with you is that is a horrible, horrible situation. Because the reality is that we human beings have many, many responsibilities. And the role of a mature person is to recognize his responsibilities. And I'd like to sort of spend a moment on mapping out some of them. If you are a husband, you have a responsibility to your wife. That responsibility is you are responsible to support her. If you happen to be in Kollel and you've agreed by mutual consent that she will work, then you probably have a much greater obligation because she's doing your job as well. In which case, you have much more of an obligation to honor her, respect her, and recognize the tremendous debt that you have. A wife has a tremendous debt to her husband. A wife has a responsibility to nurture her husband, take care of her husband's needs, both emotional and physical. A mother has a huge, huge responsibility to her children. A father has a very real responsibility to his children. Women typically are pretty good, usually are pretty good at being responsible to their children. Husbands are oftentimes nowhere near as skilled at being fathers and oftentimes nowhere near as responsible. But understanding that when I go into a marriage, I'm responsible to my wife. When I have children, I am responsible for their nurturing. I'm responsible to do whatever I can to bring them up as solid citizens. That's my responsibility. I'm responsible to earn a living, but it's not just about earning a living. I'm responsible to earn a living that's in a way that's right, that's proper, that I can bring up my family, that I can spend the appropriate amount of time with my children, that I can bring them up as I should, is one part of my responsibility. Oftentimes, it's not fun. My grandfather on Beit Stadim, on both sides, were tailors. What that means is, for a living, they sat there 12, maybe 14 hours a day at a sewing machine, sewing together pieces of cloth. How much job satisfaction do you think they had? Wow, 14 hours a day, whoa, this is a blast, this is... You see, it wasn't fun. But there was a powerful sense of responsibility that a man felt for his family. This is my achrayus. I am responsible to feed my family. I'm responsible to be the father of my children. And therefore, I'm responsible to take care of them. The sense of responsibility has to be integral to the human. It's there. It's right there within us. Within the society we live in, there's a tremendous sense of entitlement, a tremendous sense of juvenilism that allows you to feel that if it's not fun, don't do it. Don't commit yourself to anything. And we're here to party. Just take it easy. Take it very, very, very lightly. And the result of that is that people have no sense of responsibility. Part of the reason, but it's a small part, part of the reason why divorce is so rampant in this country is there's no sense of responsibility to a marriage. You see, a marriage is a commitment. A commitment is when it's good, when it's bad, I am committed to the success of this union. Even if it no longer meets all of my needs, even if it's no longer fun, should I work on it? Yes. In an ideal setting, we spent a lot of time and a number of shmuzim discussing what an ideal marriage should be. An ideal marriage should be where both partners are fully supportive and both are meeting all of their emotional, physical needs. However, that's not always the case. But regardless of whether it's 100% or 90% or 10%, there's a commitment to this union. When I give my word, when I commit myself to it, that is my binding word, and now I'm responsible to do everything in my power to make it work, even if it's no longer fun. WIIFM, the radio station that the American culture, the Western culture, listens to, WIIFM, what is in it for me? The marriage no longer satisfied me. I was no longer finding satisfaction there, and therefore I'm out of it. Now, if you've made a temporary commitment, if it's a start of marriage, or if it is a job that you took for 6 months, you can walk out. But if you've given your word, whether it be a marriage, whether it be a situation where you're a parent, whether it's a situation where you entered into a business deal, and it no longer meets your needs, no longer allows you to find fulfillment, if you've given your word, you're responsible to maintain that, even if it's no longer fun. And while it may seem obvious, I think it's almost countercultural. If you listen to what's out there in the world, these ideas of responsibility, these ideas of saying what you're going to do and doing that which you said is almost unheard of, almost non-existent. And I think the cost of it is very great. The reality is that we have many, many responsibilities. We have a responsibility to a chavrusa. If you've given your word that you're going to be there at 6:30 a.m., you have to be there because you're responsible. If you have a responsibility to your community, you have to meet those responsibilities. If you have a responsibility to a boss, you are responsible to make sure that his business thrives. Yosef HaTzadik did not have to spend hour after hour after hour signing on documents. But he was responsible to do it. Why? Because this money was fit to go to Paro. Paro would not have missed the money. Paro would not have complained. Paro would have been phenomenally wealthy without it. But that's what's right. That's what's appropriate. And even if it's not fun, Even if I'm not steiging, I'm not learning, I could be chazaring shas, I could be davening with better kavan, I could be doing many things. If responsibility demands that this is what I do now, this is what I do, even if it's not fun, because that's what a responsible person does. And I believe one of the concepts that's sorely lacking in modern culture is this concept. However, it's integral to the human. You see, the human understands this deeply within himself. The problem is there's so much out there, so much comical, so much nonsensical layers and layers that allow a person to just fluff it all off and not take responsibility. But every once in a while, when you see a powerful picture of a Yosef who takes responsibility powerfully and fully, you look back on your own life and you ask yourself, what are the areas that I'm responsible for and how am I keeping my commitments? In the Berenstein Bears, Papa Bear is a clown, but that's not an adult. And if you're a Greek goddess, it's okay to be juvenile, but not if you're a father. And if you're a father and your children ever look at you and see an image of themselves, the same juvenile, immature, just a little bit older, then that's a sorry, sorry state of affairs. You're not playing the role of a parent, you're playing the role of a grown-up child, but not very grown-up. And that one of the keys to being a parent is to be the adult, not to be the child. And that's something that requires an awful lot of thinking about, an awful lot of work. I'd like to close with one observation. My daughter, Ricky, is 16. She's played piano for many, many years now, and her teacher is a very well-trained concert pianist who really harps on technique. Ricky is now at the point where she's very, very skilled, and she now teaches little girls to play piano. A number of weeks ago, I heard her on a Sunday teaching an 8-year-old. The 8-year-old girl is doing the scales, and Ricky says to her at some point, "Well, that's good, but I want you to do it this way." And the girl does it again. Ricky says, "Well, again, that's good, but I want you to do it this way." And the girl said, but it's hard to do it that way. It's much easier to do this way." And the little girl again does it her way. Ricky says, "No, but this is the right way to do it." And the little girl says, "But it's easier to do it this way." And Ricky said these words to her. Ricky said, "If we do what we want to do, we won't be what we want to be." At which point the little girl said, "Okay." And then she played it the right way. And I said to myself, oh my goodness, a 16-year-old just said to an 8-year-old, "If we do what we want to do, we won't be what we want to be." I said, Baruch Hashem, there is hope. And I'll explain to you exactly what I mean. And you see, what that means in plain language is just because it's easy doesn't mean it's right. Just because it's difficult doesn't mean I'm not going to do it. There are many, many things that I'm going to do because I'm a mature adult and responsibility demands that I do it, even if it's not fun, even if it's not glorious, even if I'm not given honor. Even if my name won't go up in shining lights, this is what responsibility demands, and therefore I do it because it's right, because it's proper. That's what's expected of a mensch. My friends, this is one of the great secrets to success. You can motivate yourself, and you can drive yourself, but motivation will only take you to a certain extent. At a certain point in life, you have to recognize it's God, the country, the core. There are certain core responsibilities that are demanded upon me as a mensch, and I have to fulfill them because that's what's required. A sense of duty, a sense of responsibility is innate, integral to the human. It's there if we don't allow ourselves to become these comical, juvenile, Berenstein Bear, Papa Bears, if we allow ourselves to understand what an adult is. May Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, ability to put this into practice. Thank you.